And now, live from New York City via Los Angeles, California, it's time for The View from Over Here with the man who has a view for all seasons, your host, Stan Weisleder.
Hi there, everybody. This is Stan Weisleder at CRNTalk.com. I am in the studio with Malcolm Berman, making sure that I don't drop any F-bombs while on the air. Anyway, we have a few things to talk about today. Oh, Paul is looking from the control booth.
He has his hand on the trigger.
Every once in a while, I check out on him and make sure, you know, he's not reading a magazine or eating a ham sandwich and will drop one to see if he catches it. Because you people out there, you have to know there's about an 8 to 10 second delay from when we talk to when it's out on the air. And his job is to catch any no-nos.
And when Stan talks, you need about a 15 second delay. Anyway, welcome back from Florida.
All right, let's go quickly because we have a very interesting guest today. His name is Tom Dreesen, and we'll tell you more when he comes on board. But right now, let's do some of the news items. These are really not news items, but things that kind of catch my fancy. Now, I promise not to get into politics, okay? But something happened yesterday that deserves a word or two. While I was getting stamps at the Calabasas post office, I happened to pass by a young couple, male and female, and they were touting Lyndon LaRouche and promoting the removal of Obama from office based on a whole laundry list of charges and accusations, which I will not get into because politics on a radio show like this one is the kiss of death. So why am I bringing it up? While paying for my stamps, a rather loud argument ensued outside, albeit a one-sided argument, promulgated by a rather large gentleman with a booming voice that hovered over the two leaflet distributors, calling them Nazis and worse because they dared to question the president and his actions. Both sides quickly withdrew their cell phones, ready to document who would strike the first blow. But the feigned shootout ended in a draw. The point that I'm making is that the last time I looked, we still have or did have freedom of speech in this country, as long as the speech or speech maker did not advocate the taking of a life or the taking away of a person's rights under the Constitution. That's all I have to say about that aspect of politics. Malcolm, any addition?
Well, it's just the fact that sometimes might makes right. In other words, people can shout down other people as long as they have the ability to do so. And that's known as democracy.
Well, okay. Next, a frozen virus some 30,000 years old was discovered in the Siberian tundra. Could that virus be dangerous? Well, I don't know. But about 15 years ago, my wife Marilyn and I were on a glacier in Alaska where she dared to drink the melting ice that was easily hundreds of years old, or maybe even older, that contained any number of bacteria that we were no longer accustomed to. Was that dangerous? No, because what she did was to mix it 50-50 with vodka, killing all of the bacteria therein. Oh, hey, here's a good one. A drunken gambler in Las Vegas sued the casino for his losses. Now, who told the idiot to drink or to gamble? Remember what Flip Wilson, the comedian, used to say?
No.
The devil made me do it.
Devil made me do it.
And there's another one. A teenager sued his parents for college education. Someone should tell the kid to get a fucking job and to pay his own way like I did.
Go, Paul.
Did Paul catch it? I don't know. Whatever. Anyway, hey, here's one that might be of interest. According to Time magazine, Floyd Mayweather Jr., who started boxing at the age of 3, is a super boxer with a 45-0 record, and he has never been knocked down. He is also super in other ways. Like, for instance, he owns 1,000 pairs of shoes. That's more than Marilyn has, okay? And if he used only one pair a week, it would last him only 19 years. poor Floyd. He also has 10 homes, almost one for every month in the year. He has a number of bank accounts, but one of them has $123 million in it. He has 17 cars. He has 4.6 million followers on Twitter. He trains at his specialty, at his craft, for 12 hours every day. And during his boxing career, he has fought 372 rounds. And because he works so hard, he doesn't get up until 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
So he trains from 3 o'clock in the afternoon till 3 o'clock at night?
I have no idea when he trains, but that's when he gets up. According to Time Magazine, that's what they say. And they're never wrong.
Of course not. Somehow, as a spectator, I don't enjoy his style of boxing. He's very defensive. I don't know if you've ever watched him fight.
No, but what the hell? A 45-0 record, that's pretty damn good.
Now, now they say pound for pound he might be the best fighter, or he was. He's getting a bit old now.
Well, he says he's the best. He said he's better than Sugar Ray Robinson.
Well, and also Sugar Ray Leonard, if you remember.
Well, all the Sugar Rays.
all the sugars. But the fights aren't exciting.
Okay, Malcolm. All right, we just got the clue from Paul, who gave up his ham sandwich, and our guest is on board. We have a very interesting guest today. His name is Tom Dreesen. He's been around a while. He's been on, God, so many TV shows and movies.
Excuse me, Stan, everyone. I thought we were going to introduce your wife, Marilyn, that she's going to be the guest.
No.
Anyway, good morning, Marilyn. I understand you're
Tom,
hearing.
Are you with us?
Yes, I am, but I understand Maryland is 45-0 against you. Is that correct?
It's more than 45-0 against me. It's like about 100-0 against me.
Good morning, Tom. This is Malcolm Berman.
Hey, Malcolm. How you doing?
Fine.
Dan, how you doing?
Okay, Tom. Now, I have to ask you, I know what you want to talk about, and I know our listeners want to hear about Frank Sinatra, but I have to ask you, because I read your bio, and you were a shoeshine boy at one time.
Uh-huh. I had 8 brothers and sisters. And we lived in a shack. 5 of us slept in one bed. We had no bathtub and no shower and no hot water. And it wasn't during the Depression. I'm not that old. But we lived in a rat-infested, roach-infested shack. Both my parents were alcoholic at one time. So I shined shoes in taverns and from the time I was 8 years old till I was 12. I set pins in bowling alleys. I caddied in the summertime. And I sold newspapers on a corner and also had a paper out, as my older brother and my sister and I did, too, to help feed my brothers and sisters, you know. So none of this I regret, by the way. I think this is the greatest thing that ever happened to me.
It builds character, Tom.
Oh, yeah.
Which town did you grow up in?
A suburb on the south side of Chicago called Harvey, Illinois.
Ah.
It was at steel mills and factories and 38 taverns, and there were 8 in my neighborhood. My mother was a bartender in one, and my father was well-known on the other 38.
Now, you were also a high school dropout, right?
Yeah. At age 16, I was going to school. I was setting pins in bowling alleys late at night, and sometimes, if old-timers would know what I'm talking about, I'd set league games, and then there'd be a pot game. So I'd set from midnight to, say, 2, and then walk home. And I kept going to school tired and holes in my shoes and everything. And when I was 16, I just dropped out. And no one cared, but I ended up going in the Navy at age 17. And that really changed my life. I got a high school diploma from the Navy, and I went to junior college nights and began studying political science. And
now, when did you work as a private detective?
I did do that, yeah. There was an agency in Chicago called Polizzi Detective Agency, and they hired street kids. I don't have a degree from academia, but I've got a doctorate from the streets.
You know, did you carry a gun while you were a private detective?
Well, I did at one time, a 38 snub nose, but later on I didn't want to carry it with me. There's something about keeping a weapon with you that you start really becoming dependent on it or reaching for it sometimes when you shouldn't. You know, so
you reach for that instead of your wallet.
Yeah, exactly. So. But it was very interesting. You know, a lot of it was domestic cases, husband-wife tailing and stakeouts for 6 or 8 hours a day, 6 days a week, where no one did anything. You know, but we had some interesting cases that...
Not all of your stints on The Tonight Show, that would have been with Johnny Carson, correct?
I did 61 appearances on The Tonight Show, 50 with Johnny and 11 with Jay.
Wow. Did you know Stan Irwin, who was a producer of his at one time?
Sure. I used to work out and play basketball at the Van Nuys Y, and that's where I met Stan, to be honest with you.
Yeah, he's an old friend of mine. Haven't seen him in a while. Have to give him a call one day. All right, listen, you do a show that I haven't seen, and I really have to see it. We want to know where it is, when it's going to be there. Your show that you talk about Frank Sinatra being with him, your life with him, and we know that you spoke at his funeral and that you were a pallbearer. But, you know, now you talk. I'm going to shut up for a while, and you have the floor.
Well, no, what it is I'm doing a one-man show called An Evening of Laughter and Memories of Sinatra. You can go to my website, TomDreesen.com. You know, for those who are listening, it's D-R-E-E-S-E-N, TomDreesen.com. And it'll tell you whenever I'm appearing with the show or whenever I'm giving motivation speeches or just doing stand-up comedy or emceeing corporate events. It's always on my website.
How often do you get to South Florida?
You know, there's a guy there now, Howie Rapp. I don't know if you know Howie, old-time agent.
Howie Rapp, are you kidding? Sure.
He wants to book me. In next year, 2015, Frank Sinatra would be 100 years old. And Howie's wanting to book me, like, for a whole... I've got to be in Naples in January 2015 already, so we're booking way in advance.
Okay, that's on the West Coast. Are you going to do the Southeast Coast?
Yeah, that's what he's trying to do, put together a whole Florida tour, because Frank would have been 100 years old in 2015. So the show would... pick up a lot of interest, you know.
By the way, Tom, Howie was a guest on our show last week.
Oh, was he really? Yeah.
Yeah, because Stan was in Florida.
Let me give you a real fast quick story, and we'll go back to the one-man show. This is a great old comedy story that was going around for years. Back in the 40s, Charlie Rapp, which is Howie's uncle,
yes,
had the Rapp Agency. Now, this is back in the 40s, and I wasn't around then, but the comics always told this story, the old-time Catskill comics. They said that when they went on the road, when Charlie Rapp booked them on the road, rather than come back to New York City, they would call to see if there was more work while they were out there. So what they did to save money, they would call, in those days, they would call the Charlie Rapp Agency person to person for themselves. And then Charlie Rapp would say, he'd say, Charlie Rapp Agency, and the operator would say, I have a person to person phone call for a Jackie Jensen.
Right.
And Charlie would say, Jackie's not here, operator, but yeah, he'll be at the Buffalo Hyatt House next Friday and Saturday. That was the gig, and he's in room 250. That's the money, $250, right? So they said that one time this happened, he said, Charlie Rapp Agency, and the operator said, I have a person-to-person phone call for a Jackie Jensen. And he said, Jackie's not here, but he'll be at the Syracuse Hilton next Friday and Saturday, and he's in room 250. And the comic said, operator, ask him if he can get him in room 425 or 450. Charlie said, tell him he's lucky he's even in the hotel. Now, going back to my one-man show, you know, when I was a kid, here, let me digress. The theater opens, I'm going to digress again. When I was a kid growing up, if somebody said to me, played a word game with me, tall, short, black, white. If they said show business, I said Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin. To me, that was what show business was. And where I grew up on the south side of Chicago, they were revered. I mean, they were like street guys who made it, you know.
They were gods.
Yeah, they were in this enormous talent and the love they had for one another and their performances together. So, you know, my show... Is that a commercial break coming?
Yeah, it's coming, and you can tell by the music.
Okay, well, I'll tell them what intrigued me to do this.
Okay, Tom, hold on, and we'll be right back.
Yeah, Tom, you're going to be with us the rest of the show, so don't take any other calls.
Okay.
You're listening to The View from Over Here, heard on CRN Digital Talk Radio and carried on the World Wide Web at crntalk.com. You also can hear the show live and past shows on www.viewfromoverhere.com. Remember, there is no the. www.viewfromoverhere.com, and we'll be back in a few minutes. Stay tuned.
Hi there, Stan Weisleder here at the studio, crntalk.com, together with Malcolm Berman and our special guest for today, Tom Dreesen. Tom, okay, floor's yours again.
Four zeros.
Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
He's there. He's just playing with us.
Tom, I had you were a guest on, I don't know if you remember, a few years ago on Horace Heidt's show, and I was producing it.
Oh, yeah.
And you were telling this very poignant story about the last Christmas that you spend with Frank. I wish you were here because I think tears came to your eyes, and I know tears came to my eyes. Could you relate what happened?
Well, and that's, by the way, that's part of my one-man show.
Yeah.
You know, I'll get to the one-man show began because no matter when Frank died, no matter where I went, you know, no matter what I was doing, people wanted to know about Frank Sinatra. I was running a marathon for multiple sclerosis, and the CNN camera guy came up and he said, Tom Gleason's about to run his first marathon, and named in honor of his sister. And, Tom, before you start, can you tell us about Frank? And then, you know, I'm at the starting line, you know. Last week at Pebble Beach, I played up in the Pebble Beach golf tournament, and sure enough, they came out to interview me. And before they, how you playing? It was windy and rainy. But before we do that, tell us a Frank Sinatra story. So, and I knew this was going to happen. When I was touring with Frank, we were doing one-nighters all over the country. And one time we were flying into Palm Springs, and he wanted me to spend the weekend there. And I had to come back to L.A. because I was doing the Tonight Show. And he said, well, I'll call Freddie DeCordova. I'll get you out of it. You know, spend the weekend here. I said, no, it's my 50th appearance, and they're kind of making a big deal of it. He said, wow, that must be a record among comedians. I said, no, there's other comedians who've done more than me, but it doesn't matter, Frank. No matter what I do the rest of my life, I could find the cure to cancer. My obituary is going to say the comedian who toured with Frank Sinatra. And it's come to pass that no matter David Letterman, I do his show three times a year, he wants to know a Frank Sinatra story. So I finally wrote this one-man show, An Evening of Laughter and Memories of Sinatra, where the theater goes dark, a video screen comes down, and Dennis Farina, God rest his soul, narrates my life, about 4 minutes of my life. And then I come out, and it's my life from my childhood to my service years to the Tonight Show, to Sammy Davis Jr. touring with him, to working with Dean Martin, and to touring with Frank Sinatra. And then I come out and I do stand-up comedy for about 30 minutes. I segue to a bar where there's a bottle of Jack Daniels, which was Frank's drink of choice. I tell a funny story at the bar and the lights go out. And now on the screen is Frank singing. It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So I let that mood set in. When I get to the chorus, make it one for my baby and one more for the road, the light hits me, and now the audience is in a bar with me, and I've come home. And I tell them the first time I heard that voice, I was shining shoes in a bar on the south side of Chicago in Harvey, Illinois, and he was on the jukebox. And then I take them from that little boy hearing Frank Sinatra on the jukebox in Harvey, Illinois, to one day carrying his coffin out of a church in Beverly Hills. And so it's a long journey with a lot. I mean, it's a lot of laughs, a lot of laughs, and then some tears. I take him to the end, to his funeral, and to the last days of his life. And then I close with a funny monologue and toast them all with a sip of Jack Daniels, telling him, I wish for all of you what Frank Sinatra wished for you. The very last song that he ever sang on stage is that the best is yet to come. And as they're leaving the theater, Frank is singing, the best is yet to come. And that's the show. Now you don't have to go see it. Anyhow.
No, we want to see it. I want to see it.
The story that you were talking about, Stan, at Frank's 82nd birthday, we were all over the house, a bunch of his friends and family, Gregory Peck and his wife, Veronique, Jack Lemmon and his wife, Felicia, Kirk Douglas and Ann, his wife, Larry Galbart and his wife, and Sidney Poitier. There was Robert Wagner, Jill St. John, and they were bringing out we sat around and ate, and they're going to bring out the cake. Now, Frank was off to the side, and we didn't realize whether he was with us much or not. There were days that he was kind of with you, and there were days he wasn't. He passed away 5 months after this birthday. So he was off to the side and actually being fed. The woman that took care of him, Vine, this black woman that had taken care of him for years, was cutting some food for him and helping him. So we started small talk, waiting for the cake. And somebody said, where's the best place to live? And Gregory Peck and Veronique said, we have a place in Villa. We have a villa in France, I mean, and we like it there. And Robert Wagner and Jill St. John said, we have a place in Aspen, and we like it there. And Frank, off to the side, nobody thought he was with us. He had his head turned. He said, the best place to live is where your friends are.
Huh.
And the whole room got quiet, and we went, well, yes. Well, yes, of course that's true. And my point of this is, here's a man in my industry, arguably the greatest career show business has ever known, with Oscars, with Emmys, with all these great awards, and amassed a fortune, but in the end, it wasn't about any of those things. It was about relationships. And that's the last lesson Frank Sinatra taught me.
That's beautiful. Anyway, hold on to that because we think coming up to another break. And we'll have you back as soon as the break's over. You're listening to The View from Over Here, heard on CRN Digital Talk Radio and carried on the World Wide Web at crntalk.com. And you can hear us on www.viewfromoverhere.com. Know the. And we'll be back in a few minutes with Tom Dreesen.
Hi, it's Stan Weisleder back on CRNTalk.com with Malcolm Berman and our special guest today, Tom Dreesen. Tom, quickie, I never had the privilege of meeting Frank Sinatra, but a few years ago I had the privilege, together with Marilyn, of seeing him in concert. He was about 75 years old at the time, and I had heard that, you know, his voice is going and so on and so forth. But I have to tell you, he was impeccable. It was one of the highlights of all of the shows that we've seen. Unbelievable. And I've been a Frank Sinatra fan, I guess, most of my life. But as a little kid, I could not understand why those screaming girls would be screaming at his performances. And I would say, well, are they crazy? What the hell is wrong with them? And then I heard him sing a little song in a short, in a film, in the movies. It was a fill-in. It was the singing of The House I Live In. And after I heard that, I became a die-hard Sinatra fan. I even liked him in the movie, the one that everybody made fun of, the one with the traveling gaucho or the traveling singer or something like that. I can't really
remember. Was it something McGee or something dirty English?
No,
McGee?
It was one way before that. But anyway, it doesn't matter. He was absolutely incredible. But I don't want to say any more. It's your floor.
Well, you hit on two things that are extremely important to know about Frank Sinatra. You know, Frank Sinatra, one night sitting around with him and all these distinguished actors in his backyard. You know, Frank only, he went to bed at dawn. When the sun came up, Frank went to bed, and he wanted you to hang with him. So whether we were on the
road. Well, he wasn't a vampire, was he?
No, but whether we were on the road or off the road, when the sun came up, Frank went to bed. And so we'd sit in this, on the road in different places, and as well as backyard, but at the Rancho Mirage, his compound. But one night, with all these actors, Clint Eastwood and Kirk Douglas and Gregory Peck and all these sitting around, I never wanted the evenings to end. So I would throw a question out there, like, oh, Gregory, when you did To Kill a Mockingbird, and I would answer. I would sit back, and he would answer. And then I'd, Kirk, it's Spartacus, and then I would ask a question and get it flowing. But one night, I don't know what made me ask him, but I said to Frank, did you ever study acting? And Gregory Peck grabbed my arm firmly. He said, acting lessons would have ruined him. He was a diamond in the rough you didn't fool with. This is a man who danced with Gene Kelly. He won the Academy Award in From Here to Eternity and never took an acting lesson. He should have won the Academy Award in The Man with the Golden Arm. But he did the movie Suddenly, and how about The Manchurian Candidate? The point of this is, when you gave Frank Sinatra a song, to him it was a script. What did the writer feel the night the writer took pen in hand? So he would immerse himself in that lyric and become that lonely guy in a bar whose woman left him and he's never going to find love again.
So he was acting all his life.
All of it. And that's why he interpreted the lyric better than anyone out there. He was the greatest pop singer of all time. Steve Lawrence, who was a great singer, Steve once said to him one night, you know, you ruined it for all the rest of us.
Yeah, well, his phrasing was phenomenal. You're right. He was when he was phrasing his songs, he was acting. He was living that role.
You could feel that. You feel the loneliness and the hurt. You know, there's a song called If You Go Away. If your woman ever leaves you and you're in a bar at 2 o'clock in the morning and that song comes on, you'll put a gun in your mouth. You know, he's if you go away on this summer day, then they might as well take the summer.
Now, listen, many times he would give credit to this elderly lady. I think her name was Mabel or something like that. Do you recall what that was about?
Yeah, she was a saloon singer that I think that he had worked with. But he also, he always gave credit to the writers of every song. He thought that was so important that the writers and the arrangers be recognized with every song.
Right, yeah, I remember that every time before he did something, he said this was written by.
Frank Sinatra created more excitement walking out to the microphone than most people did with their whole act. He was, I don't even know how to describe him, he was larger than life. You know, there was more to Frank Sinatra than other than the fact that he was the greatest pop singer on the planet. And revered by all the other singers, but he also was this controversial figure with the mafia involved, a great actor. He danced with Gene Kelly. He was more than just a singer. He was, and then the song My Way epitomizes. No one else should ever sing that song because it epitomizes, you know, and not the words of one who kneels, the record
you know,
shows.
No one else has ever sung the song The House I Live In.
Well, by the way, that song, for those who do not know, that he got a special Academy Award
for that.
Yes,
he did, right.
But that song in concert, when he would do that in front of 20,000 people, Malcolm Stand, it would the back of your hair would stand up. Because he would sing What America Means to Me. Mm. And then when he'd get to the part, you know, the school, the house, the playground, those things, but he'd get to the part in the end, he said, but especially the people, all the lights in the arena would come up, and he would go, the people, he would be pointing at all them, and they would be standing and cheering, and it was a sight to behold.
Right, what a showman.
You know, I think it was the New York Sesquicentennial, I can't even pronounce
Susquehanna?
It right. No. No. It was, I think, the 200th anniversary, and two performers came up. It was Neil Diamond who did the Coming to America, and Frank Sinatra did The House That I Live In. The two songs together were absolutely unbelievable.
Makes sense. Well, he was a lot of things. He was a controversial, complex human being. As a stand-up comedian, we study human behavior simply because we recall that so much in our nightclub acts and stuff like that. And he was a wonderful study for me.
Tom, how did you guys get to meet?
By being glib at the right time. I had toured with Sammy Davis for years, and then I toured with Smokey Robinson, different artists. And Smokey and I were in Lake Tahoe working at Caesars, and Frank was next door at Harrah's, and I had worked there many times. So after my show one night, I bolted out. I wanted to see Frank because I was a huge fan. I bolted out off stage, ran right over to his showroom, and his daughter Nancy was opening for him at the time. And as I was running into the showroom, the vice president of Harrah's Hotel, a man named Holmes Hendrickson, saw me. And he said, Tommy, come here. He was talking to a big guy with a cigar. And I reluctantly went over there because I didn't want to miss Frank's opening. I love to watch him walk out, you know, to the microphone. And so I reluctantly went over, and Holmes Hendrickson said, Tommy, this is Mickey Rudin. Well, I recognized the name. It was Frank Sinatra's lawyer. And I said, he said, Mickey, this is Tom Dreesen. I think Tom would make a great opening act for Frank Sinatra. Hmm. And Mickey winked at the vice president, and I caught it, the wink. He said, hey, kid, if I gave you a week with Frank, would you want more than $50,000? I said, Mr. Rudin, put it this way. If you gave me a week with Frank, would you want more than $50,000?
Hold on to that thought, Tom. We're up to a break again.
Don't go away, Tom.
You're listening to The View from Over Here on CRN Digital Talk Radio. And on the World Wide Web at crntalk.com. And you can hear us on www.viewfromoverhere.com. And we'll be right back with the fascinating stories of Tom Dreesen and Frank Sinatra.
Hi there, Stan Weisleder here, back in the studio with Malcolm Berman on CRNTalk.com, and our special guest for today, Tom Dreesen. Tom, we were discussing during the break, we have a couple of questions to ask you, which you've probably heard a gazillion times. Number one, what was or what really happened between Frank and JFK? The other question is there really anything truthful about so-called connections between Frank and the mafia?
And that part of The Godfather, where the studio head wound up with the head of a horse in his bed.
Where do you want me to begin?
At the beginning.
You decide.
Well, yeah, he loved JFK. He was very angry with what Robert Kennedy did to him And it's all in a movie called Rat Pack, which historically is accurate. I actually was a consultant on the film for the guys to do comedy, Joe Mantegna, Don Cheadle, and Ray Liotta. Ray Liotta came and hung out with me for a long time to ask me questions about Frank. And then I opened, the movie opens with me on stage. But he, you know, the truth is, and Joe Kennedy, JFK's father, was a brilliant politician, knew the world politics as good as anybody. He knew John Kennedy could not win the election. There were two states, West Virginia was 95% Protestant, and they weren't going to vote for a Catholic. And the state of Illinois, the downstate Republicans were going to beat JFK. And they had it all mapped out, the strategy, but he called Frank to his home and told Frank. He said, "My son can't win the election. You know the guys to go to, and I do too, but I can't go to them." You know, Joe Kennedy was a bootlegger before he was ever this. You know, if you see the movie Godfather, Don Corleone was going to try to get his family legitimate, was going to, you know, eventually one day his dream was to get them all out of the crime and into legitimate businesses, all of the grandchildren and so forth and so on. And that's what the Kennedys, in my opinion, many people, they went from that to the legalizing. Everybody was in a legal position. So Joe Kennedy said, "You know the guys to go to. I do too, but I can't go to them." And Frank went to some people in some Chicago. They went to the unions in West Virginia. They convinced all the unions in West Virginia that the Kennedys were going to be helping, you know, pro-Hoffa and pro-unions and so forth and so on. And they swung. West Virginia came in, and the last state to come in was Illinois. They won by 13 electoral votes, and probably over 100,000 dead people voted in that election.
Who was it? Sam Giancana?
That's where they went to him. And so now they win the election. Frank spends a couple million dollars in his compound down in Rancho Mirage, building another bungalow and things like that, because he wanted, JFK promised to come and spend time at his home. And, of course, Frank was excited about that, you know, the President of the United States was going to come, and Frank was naming a bungalow after him and all that. Well, a week before, after all this construction is almost completed, Peter Lawford comes to Frank and says, "John can't come here. You know, Jack Kennedy can't come here." And he said, "Why?" He said, "Because," Bobby Kennedy said, "because you know those guys." And Frank said, "Because I know those guys? You mean those guys that, you know, that got him elected, because his dad sent me to? You mean because I know those guys? What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, he's going to stay with Bing Crosby." He said, "Bing Crosby's a Republican." You know, but anyhow, they betrayed him. Politics, as you know, can be as evil as gangland. But they betrayed him, and Frank was resentful. But he loved Jack Kennedy, and he just felt that the family betrayed him. And that's the story on that. Did he know those guys? It's an interesting thing whenever people come up with that. Ask me if I know those guys. Of course, when I first said it, now Frank was way before me. I was a lot younger than him. But when I started out in show business, those guys owned clubs. You know, remember before when I started out in show business, there were no comedy clubs in America. When Frank started out in show business, they owned Las Vegas. So do you know those guys? Of course you know those guys. They booked the clubs. They owned the clubs. And was he one of those guys? Absolutely not.
Hey, I have a question to ask you. You mentioned Las Vegas. Las Vegas today is a lot different from when it was 50 years ago, and I, for one, and every single person who I have spoken to, with no exception, they all say that they liked Las Vegas better than it was today, than it is today. They liked it better the old way.
Sure. It was more intimate, and you could get around. When I worked with Sammy Davis or Frank, we would do two shows a night, and then we'd get in the car, and we'd go to, like, six different lounges and see the Traineers and Louis Prima and Keeley Smith. And I mean, but today you can hardly get out of your hotel. They build your hotels like they're a city. There's steakhouses and Chinese restaurants and Japanese restaurants and Italian restaurants. And, I mean, there's so many activities once you get in the hotel. And then if you want to go next door, they own the hotel next door, so you can go in a crosswalk and you check in and you never leave that property, you know.
Right, but what I miss is I was telling Stan as we were driving up here is there was a certain elegance. Now I'm going back to even to the 80s, where you couldn't go into one of the casinos or a club without a jacket and tie.
Yeah, you had to be properly dressed.
Now
you
they
didn't
have
come
flip-flops.
In your underwear.
Oh yeah, it's a totally different Las Vegas. And I work there. I'll be there in May, but I work there. But I miss every time I go there. My heart aches for the days of working with Frank and Sammy. And
we have another break, but real quick, Tom, is your show going to be in L.A. anytime soon or in Las Vegas?
Yeah, I'm thinking that we're working on maybe doing the Geffen Theater here. We're in talks right now. I just finished working Theater West here with the show. You
know? Okay, hold on for our last segment. You're listening to The View from Over Here, heard on CRN Digital Talk Radio and on the World Wide Web at crntalk.com, and you can hear us at www.viewfromoverhere.com. Know the. We'll be back in a few minutes to wind up with Tom Dreesen.
Okay, we're back for our last segment. This is Stan Weisleder and Malcolm Berman on crntalk.com together with Tom Dreesen. Tom, before I forget, when you are next going to be in L.A., whenever that is, let us know because we want to have you come back and be in the studio live because it'll be more fun.
Yeah, I will do it. If I wasn't so tied up today, I'd gladly have come into the studio today. You know, I want to make something real clear, though. About our last conversation, the last 20 years of Frank Sinatra's life that I was with him, he told me on more than one occasion, how he rued the day that he ever made friends with any of those guys when he was a young kid, because he said they won't get out of your life. So for the last 20 years, he cleared himself from that element, and Barbara had a lot to do with that, because you know he's a national treasure. And, you know, when he grew up, those guys owned all those clubs. You had to know those guys to get into those major clubs and those major rooms.
Yeah, otherwise you didn't work.
Oh, you didn't work. And so he said he rued the day because he said if somebody did a favor for you, he always called in that favor. And then later on, his son, when he got older, said, you know, my dad did a favor for you. And then later on, when the grandson got older, he said, you know, my grandfather did
it
a favor.
Never
for
ends.
He said, so he rued the day. So he kept them at more than arm's length the last 20 years of his life.
I had a business associate who was friends with Gilly Rizzo.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, Gilly, of course, toured with us, and Gilly was Frank's dearest friend and bodyguard for years. And whenever people say this about Frank's sense of humor, Gilly had a glass eye, and, of course, Sammy Davis Jr. had a glass eye. So one Christmas, Frank bought a set of binoculars and sawed them in half and sent one to Gilly and one to Sammy.
That's a good one.
That's the one-man show. I'm giving you a lot of excerpts from the one-man show.
Now, my favorite thing, it's not Frank with the Rat Pack, is where Sammy Davis jumps into the arms of Dean Martin, and Dean Martin says, I'd like to thank the NAACP for giving me this trophy.
you know, there's the other thing. That kind of humor, Tim Reed and I were America's first black and white comedy team, and history shows we were the last. We wrote a book on our life, Tim and Tom, an American comedy in black and white, that's now becoming a movie. A guy named Tony Aldridge from Lemon Tree Productions is going to produce the film. It'll be about from 1969 to 1975, what it was like touring the nation as America's first black and white comedy team. And the hell we took and the torture we took from the Vietnam War was raging. I had just gotten out of the service. Students were protesting all over the streets. African Americans were burning and rioting cities down all over America. In the midst of all that, we were going across the land making people laugh with all of this politically incorrect stuff that if we did today, they'd run us out of town on a rail. But we were taking their stereotypes and making humor out of it. And,
I'd like to see you write a autobiography. You know, you tell this, you know, growing up and getting into comedy, and that sounds like it'd be a great movie.
Well, there's talk about that too, because I am the American dream. I had eight brothers and sisters, lived in a shack, shined shoes, sold newspapers, all that stuff. And now I give motivation speeches at universities and corporations.
And you had cockroaches where you lived, right?
They were our pets.
Well, I know. I lived in New York, and I know the road situation.
I could tell you a cockroach story about growing up in Brooklyn that will turn your hair on end.
Anyway, guys, we have to end this as much as we hate to.
We're ending on cockroaches. This is a great
Hey, cockroaches have been around for how many hundreds of
since
millions of years?
Times. Anyway, thanks very much, Tom, and we look forward for you to come in person.
Thanks, Dan.
All right,
thanks,
Tom,
welcome.
You take care, and we'll talk again.
You were listening to The View from Over Here, heard on CRN Digital Talk Radio and carried on the World Wide Web at crntalk.com. And you can hear all our shows at www.viewfromoverhere.com.
All over the planet.
All over the world, planet, and interplanetary. See you next week.
The View from Over Here is a co-production of Infinity X and TBG International. For further information, contact Malcolm Berman at 818-687-2784. That's 818-687-2784.